You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Iraq War officially ended in December 2011 when the U.S. pulled the remaining military units out of the country. But the costs of the war, both financial and emotional, continued to mount, especially for those who fought in the conflict. In recent weeks, the Veterans Affairs Department has come under fire for mismanaging claims made by veterans, with some of them waiting years to hear if they'll receive certain benefits. Add to that the growing problems of untreated PTSD and veteran unemployment, and you have the makings of a major crisis. We're joined now by Iraq War veterans Roy Scranton, the co-editor of Fire and Forget, Short Stories from the Long War, and by Tegan Griffith, who is taking part in an activist campaign called Storm the Hill with Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans Association. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on, Leonard.
Tegan, how long were you deployed in Iraq, and what was your role when you were over there?
I was deployed with the United States Marine Corps for 7 months to Al-Takhtum, Iraq, and I was a technical publications library program manager for an attack helicopter squadron.
And Roy, how about you?
I was deployed with the U.S. Army in Iraq, in Baghdad, mostly from 2003 to 2004.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tegan, the Center for Investigative Reporting recently reported that the Department of Veterans Affairs has more than 895,000 pending claims. What kinds of things are veterans most commonly applying for?
I think the most common things they're applying for are injuries and things that happened to them while they were on active duty. It can range from TBI, post-traumatic stress disorder, any kind of skin condition. It's really to the individual what they're applying for.
And of those claims, 70% have been sitting with the VA for more than 125 days. Is there any reason that's been given as to why it takes so long to get these claims to be processed?
No, there's not one cookie-cutter reason that we've been getting. You know, the standard is usually we've lost your record, we need some more supporting evidence. It varies, really.
So they lose a lot of records?
We hope not, because that's a lot of paperwork to fill out and complete. I'm not sure if there are, I've heard horror stories of files being shoved under file cabinets and what have you. I hope that's not true. It'd be pretty unfortunate if that did happen.
Roy, does any of this surprise you, or would it surprise any of the people you work with on this collection, Fire and Forget?
No, it's not surprising, Leonard. The cost of war, we're going to have to keep paying those for a long time. You know, as with our title, you can't just fire and then forget about it, right? The thing is, on the practical side, there's a serious problem in moving from the military, right, to the VA system. They operate different record keeping systems, and they haven't. There's not a unified electronic system, so when you process out of the military, you have to take your paperwork over to the VA, and they have to input everything by hand. And that's, it's funny because that's sort of a symbol of how difficult that process out of the military can be.
Well, that sounds like going from the year 2013 to the year 1950.
That's right. There's a real need right now to modernize that process, and it's especially key because the Army and the Marines, the military broadly, is shedding a lot of the soldiers that it hired on to fight these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's letting people out. It's getting people out on minor things that wouldn't have been a problem when they needed them, but now the wars are winding down. We can get rid of the excess personnel. And these people are filing VA claims. And so there's a surge, basically, of veterans making claims on the VA that the VA is just not prepared to handle right now, and the government is not supporting them to be able to handle that.
The VA's Undersecretary of Health Benefits has said that the backlog can be resolved by 2015. Can some of these people, Tegan, wait another 2 years? Didn't you apply for disability benefits?
Yes, I have applied for disability benefits, and I am receiving them now, finally.
How long did you have to wait?
I waited about 4 months before I got my benefits, and then when I appealed my decision, it was about another 4 to 5 month process. And, you know, in rural Wisconsin, I would have to drive at least 2 hours one way just so I could present some supporting evidence. You know, I'd have to take time off of school and work just to do that.
I'm talking with Tegan Griffith, who is taking part in an activist campaign called Storm the Hill with Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans Association. She's in Washington, D.C. right now. I guess you're storming the hill at this very moment. And also with Roy Scranton, who with Matt Gallagher has edited Fire and Forget, short stories from the Long War, a book that E.L. Doctorow has described as a necessary collection. Roy, during the war, a number of commentators noted how disconnected the public was from the actual conflict. Do you believe that disconnect about the war has carried over into how the public thinks and talks about veterans' issues now?
I think it has, Leonard. I think there's a way in which, you know, a lot of people didn't pay that much attention to the wars when they were happening. And now that they're winding down, I think there's a lot, you know, a lot of people would like to move on. I mean, a lot of veterans would like to move on themselves. There's a lot of us who would like to put these wars behind us. But, you know, we need to take a moment now and look back over the last 10 years and take stock of why we were involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, what brought us there, and really, really reckon with the costs of those wars for ourselves, for Americans, and overseas. You know, there's more than 150,000 Iraqi civilians that are dead now. You know,
well, Roy, when I've spoken to returned veterans, returned GIs, they've often said that they never talked about the reasons for the war. They just simply talked about what they had to do while they were there. Mm-hmm. So did that disconnect run both ways? Did soldiers feel out of touch with events and the discourse back home?
I think so. You know, it's there's a moral division of labor between the military and our civilian leadership. The military is a professional organization. We fulfill the missions that we're given, and you know we look to our civilian leadership to give us those missions. So there's certainly there's a way in which. You know, I remember being in Iraq and, you know, doing patrols and cordon and searches and driving around in my Humvee, and I had no sense of what the mission actually was. But that wasn't up to me. I had to do my job, and so I had to sort of bracket that. So you're right. There's a way in which the disconnect does go both ways.
But then when you came home, then suddenly you were talking about the things that other people here were talking about.
Well, I was talking about the things other people were talking about, but I was also, you know, the disconnect once I got home was that people back here didn't really seem to understand what was going on over there.
What about you, Tegan?
I would have to agree with him. There was a big disconnect. What is the saying? The Marines are at war and America's at the mall. That's my favorite. I definitely feel that way.
Well, did the public ever understand the full scope of the conflict? How much was the government's control over what stories were being told? How much has that contributed to this situation? For example, we were never shown bodies returning, so we didn't see caskets. Some stories were censored. Perhaps we were seeing a different war, not seeing much of the war, at the same time that you might have felt you were seeing too much of the war.
Right. Well, go ahead.
That's absolutely right. You know, there was an issue with the caskets, and there was an issue with government censorship and image control. But there's also, you know, there was also plenty of information about what was going on. You talk about Abu Ghraib, or you talk about Haditha, or you talk about Fallujah 2. I mean, you know, there was a lot happening that people saw and could have found out more about. So, you know, it's partly a problem of, you know, what the government wants people to see. But there's also, you know, I think there is a way in which a lot of people back home didn't want to think too much about it.
We have a caller, somebody who can add to this conversation. Hi, you're on the air.
This is Jim from New Jersey.
Yes, Kim.
I'm a veteran of the Korean, and 50 years later, when I had open heart surgery, I suffered from, PTSD, which had long been subdued by my personality or whatever. Anyhow, the point I want to make is that somebody luckily told me that there are such things as veterans advocates who will fill out all the paperwork for you and walk it through the system. When I got the application, I was so daunted by it that I just really couldn't face it. And I went to the Purple Heart Association, but the DAV, the VFW, Marine Corps League, they have veterans advocates. And all you do is just sign a power of attorney. They talk to you. They fill out the application. Even they suggest some other things that you would have left out yourself. So I don't think this is widely known. And
Tegan, is it widely known? Did you get that kind of help? Did you seek that kind of help?
Oh, the Marine Corps automatically, in our transition class, the DAV had an office in the building that our transition classes were going through, and they helped me submit my claim. But, you know, it really shouldn't have to be that way. The veterans should be able to submit their claim on their own behalf. We shouldn't have to be reaching out to, you know, constituent offices. We shouldn't be having to get Congress people involved. We shouldn't have to, but I am very grateful. The DAV is the one that helped me out in Southern California, and they were tremendous in helping me get my file claimed.
Now, I ask both of you this question. Veterans of previous wars have often resisted talking about their experiences. Has that happened with Iraq and Afghanistan vets as well?
Oh, No, I don't think so. I'm especially finding that out here with Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America while we're storming the Hill. You know, a lot of us were brought out here to tell our stories, and there were very limited spots to come out here, and that's why they brought us here, to put the personal story out there. And, you know, a lot of the guys and gals are kind of having a hard time telling their story, but they know that it's for the benefit of every one of us out there, the 2.5 million of us that are out there that can't be here to tell our stories. So I think we're very willing to tell our stories.
And have people you've talked to understood what you've gone through? Did you feel that?
I'm not so much understood. It was great to be heard and to finally tell my story to somebody that could take some kind of action. It's pretty relieving.
Yeah, I think
I
can add to that. I mean, in my experience with a lot of veterans, that you know, that people do want to talk, but as Tegan just said, you know, the key thing is to find people who can listen and to be able to tell the story in a way that people can hear what you've got to say, and sort of sometimes even just being able to translate the experience. It can be difficult, you know. Bridging that gap or that disconnection we've talked about.
Have you had problems reintegrating? Is finding work in this economy a major problem for you and other veterans? You know,
I've basically been in school since I got out of the military. So you know, the GI Bill has worked out, and the new GI Bill that the IAVA helped get passed has been tremendous for me. But I was, you know, I got out of the military in 2006, so that was long before this surge of veterans happening now. My claims were processed relatively quickly.
Tegan, what about you? Has finding employment been a problem for you?
Yes, it's been probably my biggest issue. I've, you know, my last full-time job was the Marine Corps, and that was over 3 years ago. I've had three job interviews in the past 3 years, and the people that I can get a hold of, you know, for a follow-up is they're telling me I'm not qualified. I'm not applying to be a rocket scientist or anything. You know, I'm well within my capability and my skill set. You know, and I just now last month got on food share, on food stamps. I'm applying for energy assistance. I had to sell my car because I couldn't afford it. I was using the post 9/11 GI Bill, but due to the payment delay, I had to make a choice. Do I want to work at my part time job, try and get some more hours, and try and save my credit score, or do I drop out of school? I wasn't getting paid. I didn't have my book stipend. So I had to make the decision. I had to drop out of college for that reason. So while I'm out here with Storm the Hill, they're kind of taking me under their wing and, you know, convincing me to go back to school and finish my degree.
Well, in the past, veterans often got preferential treatment. But the way yes. you're describing it, it sounds like there's almost a bias against returning vets.
There is. There's a huge gap. A lot of civilian employers don't know about our skill set, and that's kind of where we're running into. That's a bill that we're actually trying to push out here is the transition assistance. You know, you should be learning how to translate your skills into civilian speak. And so when you go to these employers and you present yourself for a position, they know you. They know your skill set. They know what you're capable of. You know, I've utilized a lot of resources back home, and I'm just kind of running into dead ends all over the place.
Well, aren't you rated as a PTSD sufferer? Do you think that all of the horror stories we've heard about PTSD has led people to be a bit afraid of the returning
right.
vets?
Yes, but, you know, I'm pretty sure it's illegal for them to ask you about your disability in a job interview. So I don't walk into a place of employment and say, hi, I'm Keegan Griffith. You know, I'm here to interview for this job, and I am a 70% disabled veteran with PTSD. I don't say that. You know, it doesn't come out. But it contributes to the stigma.
Roy, what about the people who contributed to your book? Do most of them suffer from PTSD?
You know, PTSD is a real thing. Like, lots of people have it, and it's a serious problem, and we need to keep talking about it and focusing attention on it. And, you know, and some of the people, some of the writers in Fire and Forget, you know, may have dealt with PTSD. I didn't ask them. Some of the stories are about characters who have to work through PTSD. But the thing about that that we want to be careful with, I think, is that it's also... you know, it can become a label and a stereotype, mm-hmm. you know, and I think this connects with the jobs issue. I think people can sometimes see all veterans as damaged or all veterans as traumatized victims. You know, when in fact there's a whole bunch of problems and issues and, things that you have to deal with when you come back, you know, moral problems, maybe, you know, ethical repugnance at being involved in these wars or just like, you know, transition issues that can get sometimes too easily, you know, slapped with the label or stereotyped. But the fact is, you know, veterans are people who have had a difficult experience and have, you know, done hard work. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of different things that they're dealing with.
Now, 10-year anniversaries usually get a big play. Is it your sense that the public just doesn't want to talk about Iraq, perhaps because they now question whether it ever should have happened?
Well, we're talking about it now, so that's good.
Well, we're talking about it on this show.
Right.
But when you talk about it with other people, do they seem to be all that interested? Tegan, when you speak to people in Congress, are they sympathetic, or are they concerned more about sequestration and saving a little bit of money?
You know, I think initially they are, you know, it's a 10-year anniversary, but then, you know, sequestration has seemed to work its way into every single meeting that I've had with a senator or a representative, which is highly unfortunate.
What, Roy, you were going to say something else?
Yeah, I mean, we are. There is some, you know, you can see some discussion in the media, a very little bit, you know, like on the Hill. You know, so there is this moment, and we have this moment. My worry is that, you know, the moment's going to pass, and we'll no longer be, you know, marking the 10-year anniversary, and, you know, then we'll just get on with our lives. The fact is that the act of remembering and looking back and thinking about these things, you know, whether through stories like those in Fire and Forget or, you know, longer investigative things or, you know, conversations like this one we're having, we need to keep doing that. We need to keep having these conversations and looking back. It feels like there's a blip right now and there's a moment. We need to open that up and look back.
Well, I know neither of you can speak for all veterans, but has the fact of all the information we now know about the origins of the war changed the way many veterans cope with their experiences?
I don't, you know, I think a lot of the veterans that I'm out here on Storm the Hill with are just like me in the fact that, you know, we enlisted in the post 9/11 era. We knew what we were getting into. We did it for a sense of service and a commitment to our country. We didn't really go into it, you know, having some kind of political agenda. We did what we had to do. We served honorably, and now we're here fighting for our benefits that we shouldn't have to fight for.
Roy, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I have to agree in second what Tegan said. You know, it's an all-volunteer force. Nobody was drafted and sent overseas to fight a war they didn't want anything to do with. I mean, when you join the military, you have an idea of what you might be in for. But I think, you know, I can speak for myself and maybe a few others at least. You know, one of the marked things and remarkable things was in you know, all the revelations that have come out and even just in being overseas was sort of just how badly the whole thing was fumbled. And so it's less a sense of, for me anyway, of moral outrage and more one of, you know, outrage as a citizen and as a former professional in the military of how it just, we just kept fumbling things for years. You know, on the civilian and the military side, and that's what's most upsetting. It's just how badly we did the whole thing.
Thank you both so much for being on our show. Roy Scranton is the co-editor with Matt Gallagher of a book called Fire and Forget: Short Stories from the Long War. It's published by DeCapo. And Tegan Griffith is taking part in an activist campaign called Storm the Hill with the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans Association. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on, Leonard.